This could be recording our voices now. Mm-hmm. And we'll check on that in just a second.
This is Bill Alderson of the State Historical Society of Wisconsin staff. And I have with me in our recording room at the Society headquarters Professor Aaron Ide of the University of Wisconsin Chemistry Department. Professor Ide, do you live in Madison?
Yes, I do.
And you've lived here for quite some time.
Well, I've been in Madison since 1942.
But you were born up
In Nuna.
In Nuna.
Yeah.
And when was that?
That was in 1939.
1939.
Yeah.
Now, I think we've got enough of that preliminary. Now, I've turned it down here, Professor Ide, and we'll begin our discussion. Well, we picked out in this piece that I have in front of me certain areas to talk about. And one of these areas, and the one we'll begin with, was your work at the Blue Valley Cheese Company in Chicago, Illinois.
Yes.
Is this your first scientific job?
Well, it was the first full-term scientific job. I had picked up a little extra money at the university when I was an undergrad doing analysis of the science material. They were selling butter around the Middle West, but shipping a great deal of it into the New York market.
Your work was in the research branch. What particular kind of research engagement?
Well, actually, it was perhaps a little of everything, and perhaps the research label gives it more dignity than it really deserves. In part, we used to drop everything and publish it when it was necessary. If some consumer turned up the butter to the green specs, and we had to find out what the green specs were, where they came from, and what if there was anything happening again. Butter had a bad flavor, and we had to work on that. Research that was done was largely of practical part. Figuring out ways of making butter of better quality from cream of inferior quality, keeping the quality up to a good standard, and generally keeping an eye on chemistry changes and their production. Shortly after I came there, there was a great deal of interest in expanding activities into new food products. I came there in 1931, which you remember was the depth of the Depression.
Wow.
And the company began thinking that it would be more economical for their salesmen to distribute several products than to distribute just butter.
Yeah.
So one of the first jobs that I work down there was the production of cream cheese. This, of course, is a product of long standing, but we still did quite a bit of work in the laboratory. And developing methods of preparation and politics and so on that would turn out a good scientific knowledge. After this is completed, those plants that were receiving milk began producing things for the Blue Valley market. Then we get involved in a very large-scale operation connected with salad dressing, mainly $1,000 salad dressing. Now, we must have spent about 3 years, and most of our time was devoted to working out formulas that would result in a good quality product. The consciousness of expense of the final product, and getting factory operation going. And then after we had the stuff on the market, where there was this continual battle to keep quality up and eliminate some of the boiling problems that we hadn't anticipated in our original naive approach. I think that you might be interested in one of the situations that I became involved in the laboratory. I think it illustrates some of the difficulties that occurred between the laboratory and the front office. After Blue Valley Mayonnaise was on the market for perhaps a year or two, the competitive situation became very bad. Kraft had just come out with a miracle whip, and this patient was a serious competitor. It was selling several cents below our product, and it was causing other competitors to lower their prices, so the semi-price war was going on. Our board of directors decided that they would like to lower the price of Blue Valley products for an 8-ounce jar. And the laboratory was directed to do some work in changing the formulas and looking around to substitute oils, of course, with the regular and so on, so as to bring the cost down. The thinking seemed to be that the whole drop in price has to come out of raw materials. Well, I sat down at this point after working out several formulas which gave a fairly satisfactory product, or the simple inferior to what they had been producing. And in figuring this whole thing out, I found out that the total cost of material, egg yolk, cottonseed oil, vinegar, salt, and so on, plus the jar, plus the label, plus the cap for the jar, only came to 4 cents.
4 cents.
So to drop the price 4 cents, we would have had to have sold the consumer air.
The implication of the overhead was pretty high.
The overhead was pretty high. The cost of distributing the product, the cost of advertising, the management expenses, and so on, were eating up. I suppose the product, well, the 8-ounce jar of mayonnaise was selling for about 16 cents at that time, and they wanted to cut it to 12. Well, knocking 4 cents off ingredients would have left us with nothing. So it was, I think, a rather eye-opening thing for the board of directors.
And you didn't go through with this.
We didn't go through with this particular product. No. I am sorry to report that, that an inferior product was put on the market. But it was not possible to go through with the original intention.
Yeah. Well, this was during the Depth of Depression.
It was.
The competitive struggle was rough. Yeah.
In fact, we ran into some very strange competitive products. One of our salesmen one day brought in a pound of butter, which was being sold at a ridiculously low price. On analysis, this butter proved to have something over 50% water in it. And none of us in the laboratory would have believed that it was possible to work this much water into butter. The stuff literally leaked when we took the wrapper off. But it was on the market and being sold, and in competition with a different product.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I suppose this is as good a place as any, perhaps, to ingest the name of Professor Hunziker.
Professor Otto Hunziker was director of the laboratory. He had come to the company in 1916, if my memory is correct, from the chairmanship of the dairy department at Purdue University. He was a Swiss origin, had come over to the United States as a youth, and had been educated at Cornell University. He taught at Purdue for a number of years, and in 1916, Duvalli induced him to start their laboratory and become director of their manufacturing department. So he was there in a dual role as manufacturing department manager and director of research. At the time that I was connected with the laboratory, he really did no active research of his own, though I suppose in the early days he had spent some time in the laboratory. There was also a bacteriologist in the laboratory, William A. Cordes, who served as Dr. Hunziker's second in command and was my immediate superior. In addition to that, we usually had a handyman around the laboratory who washed bottles, took cultures taken care of, and did such routine analytical and synthetic work as could be assigned to a high school graduate. So it was really a four-man operation.
Now, Professor Hunziker had made a reputation in butter production.
That's right.
Was this while he was at the Blue Valley Company? Or
his reputation was quite well established before he came to Blue Valley. I forget when he was born, but at the time that I came to Blue Valley, he must have been in his mid-50s.
Okay.
He had been a hard worker. He had a good deal of insight into the problems that were connected with dairy production. And at Purdue University, he had published quite extensively in connection with off flavors in butter, quality control, improvement of cream for the production of better butter. I suppose it was this that attracted him to the Blue Valley organization in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. He may have had some consulting connections with the firm before he actually started their laboratory. He also had a deep interest in condensed milk and milk powder, and was the author of a book on that subject as well as a book on the butter industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that he was, when he was with Blue Valley, he looked upon as one of the leading authorities, not only in America, but in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He, on one occasion, had been invited to Australia and New Zealand to consult with the government there on some of their butter production problems. He was sent by the U.S. government as a delegate to the International Dairy Congresses, which took place at about 5-year intervals. I remember the first year that I was with Blue Valley. I came on July 1st, and he left shortly thereafter for the International Dairy Congress in Copenhagen. So he was a very outstanding man in his field. I suspect that his fame would have been even greater had he stayed in academic work, because he was been with a past graduate student and contributed more to a research than he was able to at Blue Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Although even at Blue Valley, he did attempt to keep some research activities going that would be of general interest, and he had an understanding with the management that he would free the public results that came out of the work of the laboratory, at least results that were of general interest.
Mm-hmm. Can we attribute any discovery or advances in butter production to him?
Well, I think that he had a great deal to do with the introduction of neutralization of cane prior to turning. At the time that I became involved in the dairy industry, it was customary for butter to be produced by centralized creamery, so-called. And farmers accumulated their cane until they had a cane farm, and then took it to the railroad station, and it was shipped to Chicago or to Milwaukee or Kansas City or any of the other Blue Valley centers. Other companies had simple similar arrangements. If a farmer had a lot of cows, he filled a can fairly quickly and good quality cream reached the creamery. But if he had only a few cows, why, it might be a week or two before sufficient cream accumulated to train the cream.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these farmers didn't have refrigeration. The sanitary arrangements that prevail on dairy farms now were very seldom in existence then, and so a quite poor quality cream was being produced in many cases. Well, the creamery wanted to buy everything, so they were buying some good cream and a lot of poor cream. Cream that was very sour, sometimes had developed off flavors, sometimes had even accumulated insects and rodents. In those cases, Blue Valley dumped the stuff and sent the farmer a note and usually lost them to the customer.
Yeah.
We don't know what other companies did. But every so often, the rat didn't appear until it was dumped into the big vat. And then it was generally ignored.
His
immediate contribution was the recognition that the quality of butter could be improved if the very sour cream were neutralized with lime or soda ash. To cut the acidity down to about 0.2%, which is normal. And then after pasteurization, cider culture was added to the vat, and the cream was ripened to an acidity of maybe 0.5% of lactic acid. And in the ripening process, a lot of flavor development takes place. The bacteria which produced lactic acid also produced flavoring compounds, very tiny traces, really. And the butter that is turned from such cream is far better in flavor than if it had been turned from the raw from the cream as we see. So that this is an advance that no doubt would have taken place without Dr. Humphreywood, but I think he had a lot to do with introducing it and controlling it in the best possible way. The butter industry is one where production is very high in the summer, especially the early months of summer, and low in the winter time. At least that was the case then. This has been leveled out from modern practice. So creameries produce more butter than they can sell in the month of June. And that goes into storage. In storage, it begins to deteriorate. And in some cases, the deterioration is very fast. Sometimes it has been up for many months. The neutralization process improves the storage quality of butter.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Hunfiger had some role in the recognition of the factors responsible for development of fishing in Butter. But not he alone, recognized that the fishingness is due to climatal means, which forms from the decomposition of lecithin in the Butter sap. And this decomposition is enhanced by high acidity and high salt. So butter going into storage was manufactured under conditions of low acidity, yet consistent with good flavor development, and low salt. So that the storage quality of the butter was greatly improved as a result of this work in Pennsylvania. Well, at the time that I came there, he was interested in pH of butter. pH is a measure of effective acidity in a food product. And his previous chemist had started doing some work on that. I continued this work as opportunity provided, and we were beginning to see some correlation between the pH of the butter at the time that it is taken from the churn and the keeping quality of the butter. We never really pushed this research to its proper conclusion, but we did get some information that was useful.
You could also, with maybe the passage generalization is too strong, but it just seemed to me in listening to you here that perhaps you could accept more cream.
Yes.
From the farmer than you had been able to previously.
Yes.
Which has helped the farmer, it would seem.
Actually, we were accepting anything that came without rodent or insect contamination and trying to do the best possible job with it. But through Hunsiger's work, it was possible to make a better quality product out of a moderately inferior raw material than had been possible by just ordinary processing of the raw material.
Then you moved on to the university. Did you move on to the university from Blue Valley?
Yes, I did. I left Blue Valley in January 1938 and came back to the University of Wisconsin to do grad work in the chemistry department. And I became a graduate student with Professor Studi, who was carrying on the activities in food chemistry and planetary chemistry in the chemistry department. Now, this must not be confused with the biochemistry department. His activities were in the chemistry department.
What was his first name?
Henry A.
Henry A.
Yes.
S-C-H-A-E-T-T-E. We got that in. What kind of a gentleman was he?
He's still living. He's emeritus professor of chemistry since 1956. He came to the university in the first decade of the century and did his undergraduate and graduate work at the university. He received his PhD under Professor Richard Fisher, who was at that time state chemist as well as professor of organic chemistry. Even before he finished his degree, Studi began teaching some of Fisher's courses which dealt with food legislation and control of adulteration, and continued teaching these courses through the years. He also taught a course in water analysis, which dealt with sanitary control of water and handling of sewage. Studi was most active in fatty oil studies and made quite extensive contributions toward understanding of the composition of fatty oils. My own work with him departed somewhat from his major fields. I did my master's study on content of lead in honey, this is a contaminant of honey, not a normal contaminant. And then I picked up a problem which was left by one of his prior graduate students dealing with the trace component of the unsaturated portion of rye germ oil. This problem also got into some vitamin problems, and this tied in with my minor, which was taken under Professor Harry Steenbach in biochemistry. Trudy's laboratory at that time was about at the height of its success. There must have been about a half dozen graduate students working for PhDs and several more working for masters in this period, in the late 30s and early 40s. Trudy became president of the American Oil Chemist Society while I was one of his graduate students. He had been chairman of the Agricultural and Food Division of the American Chemical Society back in the 30s, and he later became president of the Wisconsin Academy of Science and Arts and Letters, so that his activities were fairly wide-ranging.
Yes, they were extensive, weren't they? Mm-hmm. Would you say that he was interested in the problems of legislation, too?
Yes, he was.
And how to protect the consumer in the broad meaning of that.
So. Yes, he was very much interested in consumer protection. Mm-hmm. And this is where I picked up my own interest in consumer protection. Mm-hmm. Trudy's course used to include a good deal of material dealing with types of adulteration of food and the kinds of things that were happening to consumers. As well as purely analytical problems in detecting adulterations and such types of analyses that were used in quality control. I had had an undergraduate course from him in my last semester as an undergrad, and this actually did a lot to initiate my interest in food chemistry. So that as graduation was approaching, why Professor Collenberg inquired one day as to whether he had somebody for the Blue Valley job. Collenberg and Hunziker had been friends, and Hunziker had been coming to Wisconsin for his chemist through Collenberg. And this is how I happened to be tied up there. Then later on, I came back and did graduate work at Trudy. Although I had originally intended to do my dad working on any chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got you to a point where you're entering in your graduate work, and of course you've things are published and so on. But the war came.
Yes.
World War II came. Had you completed your degree by the time the war broke out?
I completed my degree in 1941, before the war broke out. Mm-hmm. I took a teaching job at Butler University and was there when Pearl Harbor occurred. Mm-hmm. And I came back to the University of Wisconsin in the next autumn, 1942.
Well, now, was the university engaged in... That is, and you were in the chemistry department.
That's right, yeah.
And was the chemistry department engaged by the government to do any particular work for them?
Yes, there were a number of professors who were involved in pieces of research that was thought up by governmental agencies, and these men were called upon as a result of particular competency in the field. I was... completely involved in teaching during the war years, but I can remember very well that ever so often one of our colleagues just disappeared.
Oh.
And when you inquired of the right person, you heard that he was at the metallurgical laboratory in Chicago, or possibly at MIT, or some odd place like Oak Ridge, Tennessee, or Hanford, Washington, people were quietly disappearing as the war period moved on. In fact, a few of them might even have disappeared before the U.S. became actively involved.
Is that right?
Yeah. John Willard disappeared fairly early.
And what was his...
He was connected with the Chicago Metallurgical Laboratory and then later became involved in the Hanford, Washington development of plutonium. Farrington Daniels became involved fairly early. He was involved in a number of ways.
We stopped on that last tape where you were talking about these men that would disappear from time to time. Willard and Farrington Daniels.
Yeah.
What was Daniels' particular specialty as regards this disappearing act that he put on?
Well, I'm not sure about some of the early disappearing acts, but he did ultimately become involved in the atomic bomb wars.
And do these people that were involved in it, do they talk about this at all? Did they at the time?
Well,
or
they didn't at the time.
Not at the time.
No.
They were under...
They were under very rigid restrictions about the activities that they were involved in. So they didn't talk to any of their colleagues about it. One could put two and two together and guess what was going on. Those of us who were in chemistry knew that there were activities toward developing nuclear energy. Those of us who were not involved in the Manhattan Project had the feeling that this would be 30 or 40 years before anything practical came out of the war. But we knew that, we guessed that work was going on in Germany and that the U.S. was doing work to counter.
I just want to stop this for a second now. All right, now we'll continue. Were there any particular problems or projects that the chemistry department here at the university was engaged in as far as in helping the war effort?
Yes, Professor John Williams was rather extensively involved in a project that was tied in with blood plasma extenders and composition of blood plasma. He, of course, had been in charge of the university's ultracentrifuge since it was obtained in the mid-20s. And the ultracentrifuge was an important tool in studying the kinds of proteins which are present in blood plasma. So that Williams had a very active research program going in connection with this. Williams' group was also using electrophoresis and various other techniques in these studies, but the ultrasynthesis was the center of the activity.
Did this result in any kind of method for caring for blood plasma or something that could be applied in the war effort at that time? I suppose it's awfully difficult to really
it's difficult to pin this down. I suspect that there were improvements in the handling of blood plasma as a result of better knowledge. And the work did tie in with the development of gamma globulin after the war ended, as a means of inoculating against German measles and certain other diseases. So that some practical results came out of it ultimately, though I'm not sure how much of it actually tied into the war effort. Professor Homer Adkins also had some war research going on in connection with ointments that could be used for treatment of gas burns. That is, the United States army was fearful that one of the enemy might begin using mustard gas or Lewisite if things became very tight. And so they carried on extensive research to try to get agents which would counteract the blister gases if they were used. And the action research was tied in quite extensively with that. And of course, all organic chemists in that day were interested in antimalarials, and many organic chemists were preparing compounds for screening, usually on ducks, to see whether the compounds might have promise as an antimalarial agent. You remember our quinine supply was almost nil on that day. Yeah. And, of course, atabrine was being produced commercially in treatment of malaria, but they were after other compounds that might have promise. Atabrine left the patient yellow, and it had some side effects. It didn't have exactly the same effect as quinine. So some of our people may have been working on such compounds. I do happen to know that some of them, after they left Wisconsin, that is, after getting their degrees, were tied in with the antimalarial program.
And Hirschfelder was a name that you gave me earlier, when we were talking before. Was he engaged in a particular research project?
Yes, Hirschfelder left the university fairly early, as I recall. He had come here in the mid-30s as a theoretical chemist, and he was one of the people who disappeared early and was connected with problems concerning conventional explosives, and toward the end of the war, I believe he had some connection with the atomic bomb development. After the war was over, Hirschfelder was one of the specialists who was sent to the Pacific Islands where the first test bombs were dropped. Mm-hmm. He was an observer and test able and test baker, as I remember. Mm-hmm.
Is he back at the university now?
Yes, he is back. He is director of the Theoretical Chemistry Institute. He's quite deeply involved in military chemistry. Not so much from a practical standpoint as from a theoretical standpoint. Of molecular motion and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
So that his activities have expanded a great deal since he has come back.
Mm-hmm. Was Farrington Daniel doing work on his solar?
No, he was not doing, on solar energy at all.
Mm-hmm.
Daniels was very actively interested, in addition to the immediate war work, in the development of nitrogen fertilizers. From the time that Daniel came to the UW, in fact, from the time of his World War I activities with the U.S. government, he was a very young man at that time. He was connected with the nitrogen fixation program, which led to muscle shoals and harnessing of hydroelectric power for production of nitrogen fertilizers. Well, during the 20s and 30s, Daniel's principal research was in connection with oxides of nitrogen and physical chemical behavior. So by 1940, he was thinking in terms of applying what was known about reactions of nitrogen and oxygen to the conversion of atmospheric nitrogen into nitric oxide. And once this is obtained, it is easily converted into nitrogen fertilizer and into nitric acid for munitions production, if you wish. As soon as his, even during the war, he was working on improvement of gas-fired furnaces and counter-current operations for the conversion of air into nitric oxide. Of course, Daniels is a man who has several projects going at once and is doing a full-time job on each one. He had a big project going in the late 40s at the university on mineral analysis for uranium content. And he had a large number of people working on mineral samples from all over the world for uranium content. He was also, I believe, the director of the Argonne Laboratory for a few years in the late 40s, and was actively attempting to promote government interest in the design of a power-producing reactor.
Nuclear reactor for public?
To produce power, to be used for electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. He ultimately became discouraged about this. The Atomic Energy Commission was much more interested in destructive effects of nuclear energy than use of it by consumers. And he severed his relationship with this program, and the first power reactor was put into use in England, rather than in the USA, where we have a number of them going in the USA now. He became interested in solar energy about the time that he gave up on the power reactor. In looking at the whole picture, he came to the conclusion that uranium would be available for only a limited period in the future for large-scale power production, and decided that the sun had to be trapped into giving up more of its energy. And so he's been on his solar energy boom ever since.
Yeah. So you figure the sun is going to stay around a little longer.
The sun is going to stay around for another 2 billion years at least. But if you start using uranium for power production, if there anything like the present consumption of power in the U.S., it will be used up in a few centuries.
Looking ahead.
Yes.
Now we've got a third area to talk about, which is, as I've got it on this little sheet, historiography of biochemistry. And I don't know whether we want to accept where you're involved here in your particular research and investigations in history. I don't really want to limit it just to biochemistry. That's my point.
Perhaps we shouldn't, because I have actually done very little on the history of biochemistry.
Except that your present project is concerned, but of course we'll be hearing more about that later. But in the mid-40s, sometime in there, as I have gone over your list of publications, I just came up with this bit of information. Your investigations in scientific chemistry. Not a good way to put it, I suppose, but turned more to a historical trend. And just where did you get this desire? And I know that somebody told me, now I'm going to pass on wrong here, but that you said it's the first course in the history of chemistry here at the university?
No, actually, I revised the history of chemistry at UW. I taught the revised course in the summer of 1946, and have been giving it regularly ever since, usually in the second semester of each academic year. Well, I suppose I have always had a deep interest in history, though I had very little academic work in it. In fact, none beyond high school. But I always had leanings that way. Second, I have never amounted to much as a bench chemist. Experimental chemistry is interesting to me from the intellectual standpoint, but not from the day-to-day drudgery that is involved.
And there is a lot involved?
Or 99% of it is drudgery. The 1% is a pain. But you have to do a lot of making up of solutions with various team calculations, or machine adjusting. Chemistry is becoming a machinist job in mid-20th century. And you probably spend more time looking for the tube that has burned out in the instruments than you do in in collecting actual data and interpreting it. Well, I have had a deep interest in teaching and thought of a long-standing interest in history and a lack of temperament to be a good bench chemist. So I think the net result of all of these things has caused me to become serious about history of chemistry. It's an area where I can grapple with the intellectual aspects of the subject and the human aspects of the subject without putting up with the day-to-day drudgery of the chemistry laboratory. History of chemistry was taught at the University of Wisconsin long ago, Yes, Professor Kramers of the Pharmacy Department taught the first history of chemistry course around 1908 or thereabouts. Taught it as a seminar in his home at night. And soon it became formalized as a course. And then one year, I haven't checked this, but around 1920, Kramers was on leave for a year and asked Louis Kallenberg of the chemistry department to teach the course for him in his absence. Well, Kallenberg never gave the course up. So Kramers started a history of pharmacy course.
And thereby hangs the tail.
The history of pharmacy, of course, is a flourishing subject at Wisconsin. George Erdang came around 1940 from Germany and established the Institute for History of Pharmacy with Kramer's support. And Len Sonnebecker is director of the Institute now. In the history of chemistry, Kallenberg kept teaching his course until his retirement in 1940. And the course was passed on to Professor Norris Hall, but it was never offered in the subsequent years, because these were war years, that may be a factor. But around 1945 or 6, I decided to ask if I might give such a course, and Professor Matthews, who was chairman of the department, told me that he thought it would be a fine idea to get it back on the road. And Professor Hall said he had no interest in giving the course and would be happy to have me take it. So this
As you were doing your research, was on honey. This would have been, I guess, your master's.
This was my master's.
Did you run across a great deal of information on the history of honey in the census? Because I know there was a paper that you had published.
Yeah, Dr. Trudy and I did a bibliography of early records.
Early records on honey.
On honey. Yeah. Yes, I ran into quite a bit of material on the history of honey in North America, as a matter of fact. Professor Trudy and his sister who was a librarian in Green Bay, did a previous bibliography in the 1930s on hunting. And he continued to accumulate additional references, and I also was interested, so that we did the second bibliography, I think, in 1947. So I was interested in history of food, scientific history of food, even then. And this biochemistry project, which I hope to embark on soon, will get me back into that field. I've drifted away from it somewhat.
You'll get back into it with both feet, so
yes, but I'm looking forward to that.
There is another question that I had down here, and I don't know just where this is going to lead it, but I thought we might try it. It refers to other chemists. Now, you've mentioned several already who had an interest in history, that is at the university, the history of chemistry in particular. Is this common among chemists?
It was fairly common 50 years ago. It's very uncommon now. Yes. In fact, the modern young chemist is very impatient with history and believes that he is making history and doesn't need to concern himself with what came before. There are many trends that are responsible for this. 30 years ago, it was common when a scientist published a paper to include a historical introduction of what had been done in the field. This is almost totally lacking from the modern paper. Of course, we're getting more scientists active in the field. You may realize that of all of the scientists who have ever lived, more than 90% are living today.
Well, now that's crazy.
Yeah.
Yes, now that's very
exciting. Yeah, this is an explosion. So, as a result, you have a lot of people finding out new things and looking to publish this. So editors are deluged, and they are rejecting more papers, and they're asking people to talk them down while the historical introduction is the first thing to go. As a result of this, I think it's very important that history of science be encouraged as a discipline, because the scientists themselves are not bothering to preserve the historical record, so that I think we need professionals to do the job for them. And I feel that going into this area is perfectly respectable, although I had trouble convincing most of my colleagues
for 15 years.
they were the ones that wanted to rush off and make this.
Could you mention any, as long as 90% of them are living, we'll assume that there'll be contemporaries of yours who did a job in history of science of some merit or demerit, if it happens to be that way.
Incidentally, I'd like to interject that I think that it's important that we record some of the mistakes as well as the successes. There's a misconception that science has greater powers than it has, and there are many more mistakes being made than successes.
The blind alley. You don't call it a blind alley, do you?
Well, it's the blind alley only after you've left it.
I see. I always had the idea that, and it's apparently mistaken, that a scientist never was in made a mistake. It's just that it led down a blind alley, and it was fruitless after that, so he's going to something else.
Well, you isn't going to realize that it's a blind alley when you start down it.
No.
But after getting nowhere for a while, obvious that this is what it is. Of course, a lot of these blind alleys are really not as blind as they appear to be. Sometime later, somebody else is going to carefully move through the door. And sometimes the work that has been done initially is good background work.
Yeah.
It's going to be used.
Save you a lot of
lot of...
If only it gets ugly. A lot of this blind alley stuff never gets into print. And is completely lost when somebody else wants to do the problem in a truthful way.
Well, this maybe is where your history
I thought this
is an age.
And something else.
Yeah.
For
so the practicing room. Scientists.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the Area 4 here in the land area. And we've got anecdotal sketches, perhaps, of some of these men that you've been acquainted with who are practicing scientists, that's a good way to put it. I'll just throw out a name and you can go to town on it in whatever way you want to.
I'll try.
But let's take Elvium.
Yeah.
For a start. What kind of a person was Mr. Elvium?
Well, my own contact with him caused me to feel that he was a serious, understanding person in his field. I found him to be almost completely humorless, almost completely one-track in his activities. He was deeply interested in the biochemistry of nutrition. He read virtually everything that was coming out at the time, and around 1930 this was possible. He spent long hours in the laboratory. He was a very able person in directing the work of a large number of people. He had usually a number of projects going at once. And his students rarely spent much of their 4 or 5 years of PhD study on the problem that they wrote their thesis on.
Now, why was that?
Well, he would have the younger ones doing handiwork for the older ones. And in that way, they were getting their training in practical nutrition studies, analytical work, and so on. And they were contributing to the success of a fellow who had been around so long that he was becoming an embarrassment. And ought to get a thesis written pretty soon. So maybe half a dozen people would be involved in cleaning up a thesis problem. And they may include people that have been around longer, they're going to come in a similar way from younger people coming in. Elvium had a very widespreading knowledge of what was going on in the nutrition field in his day. I remember one of my own grad student friends, under Professor Curry. I was working on a vitamin C and milk problem, and each time Elvium would see him, he would ask him how things were going, and the staff would describe some of his problems, or Elvium often had an idea or contribute that was worth pursuing. Some of them worked, some of them didn't. Well, he knew so much about the vitamin C that he could make a useful suggestion to virtually any phase of that.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Now, I don't think that he had a great interest in things afield from vitamins. I think that when he took the deanship of the graduate school, that he found himself quite tough to understand the first problem that were completely outside the vitamin C. And I think this is particularly true in the non-scientific areas that he had to deal with.
If you didn't have anything more there, how about making a comment on Spector Link?
Well,
what is it, John Paul?
It is Carl.
Carl Paul.
Carl Paul Link. And he uses all three of the name of the papers. Lake is a completely different person from what Elgin was. Naturally very brilliant and far-ranging in his thinking, and highly unorthodox in his points of view. I suppose Link has been the biggest gadfly in the lives of the rest of the biochemistry department. Because he usually took an unorthodox point of view towards things.
Did he do this for good reason?
I think partly it's a personality matter with him, he likes an argument. And he sees a different point of view and certainly expresses it for the sake of an argument. Also, I think that he felt that some of his colleagues were self-taped, and this was a way of joking them.
Well, we get a rise, for sure.
Link would take a student who the others thought lacked promise under his wing. And make a good biochemist.
Make a good biochemist.
Link also has a deep interest in history and science. He is the one biochemist who sends students over to prison and talk. The rest of them, I don't think, make any effort to have their students avoid the course, but their students are kept so busy on their own affairs that they just don't take time for this to finish it. In spite of his unorthodoxy, Link has made some